Good morning, and thank you so much for the nice welcome. It's always a treat to come back here. Many years ago, I had the good fortune to hear the South African playwright Athol Fugard give a lecture on the theater, on its meaning, in essence. In his view, theater began when the first cave dwellers emerged from their caves, sat around the fire, and somebody said, "Hey, listen, this is what happened to me." Our stories, it would seem, can shape us, sustain us. They can define us to ourselves and each other. They most certainly offer a pathway to connect to one another, to our families, to the larger circle of life. I have a friend, Polly, who's a brilliant woman. She's a professor of world cultures. And she was telling me about the Luba people of Central Africa, about whom she is an expert. The Luba will document their stories through intricate beadwork, often creating elaborate artifacts known as lukasas, or sometimes stringing beads in an intentional way into a necklace. Now, the reading of those beads, the telling of the stories, the deciphering of their code depends upon who has the standing to do so, who has the authority to wear the necklace or to even restring the beads. And the meaning of those stories is fluid, changeable over time, depending not only upon the arrangement of the beads and who's doing the telling, but the time and place in which the story is told. Not so different, really, from the way we recount and tell our own stories and histories using the language of words. Changeable over time, depending upon who's doing the telling and the time and place in which a story is told. But I love the creativity of this, the artistry involved in creating an object in the way that a word can never really be. While our stories may sustain us, they can also haunt us. Either way, they also provide the opportunity, maybe even the invitation, to make some spiritual sense of our lives, deciding what it all means. How do our stories intersect with our beliefs, our understanding about any kind of truth, about larger reality? And the clarity that they offer, though, can be as changeable and vanishing as maybe the arrangement of beads on a necklace. But still, they can offer us this opportunity. Sometimes they offer us just a guide to see us through a particularly challenging time. I have a patient, Norma, in her 70s, recently diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And she told me, "Michael, I get a lot of strength from watching the movie of my own life play in my head." She draws her strength from the very challenges she herself has faced. By slight contrast, many years ago, I worked for a hospice, and I had a patient, Harold, who was in his mid-80s and had suffered a quite debilitating stroke. Every week I visited Harold, and every week it was the same thing. He would recount the same five or six stories, the same five or six events from his life over and over again, in rapid-fire succession in this closed-loop kind of tape, reliving each moment as he told it. And then I met the most beautiful woman in the world, and we fell in love, and we got married, and we were so happy, and then she got sick, and she died, and the Germans, they were shooting at me, and they killed my buddy right in front of my face. And so it went for an hour, or for however long I would sit there. If I tried to interrupt Harold's loop and ask him a question, "Harold, how did you meet your wife, anyway?" he got a little irritated, as if awakened from a trance. What was that? He would answer me, but he would go right back to the comfort of his chant. 80-plus years of life had all been refined and distilled down to five or six stories, five or six beads on his necklace. Who would we be without our stories? As one who loves to collect objects from my travels, I love the idea of imbuing an object with meaning. The object stays the same, but the meaning might change and evolve over time. Sometimes, though, it can be tempting to confuse the object with the meaning itself. Lourdes was razor thin, in her 70s, wheelchair bound, rectal cancer, tenderly cared for by her son, Enrique. But on this particular day, she was very distressed in the infusion clinic and very tearful. She told me the story of how decades earlier she left her native Puerto Rico and that her mother had given her a few precious pieces of jewelry to remember her by. Well, Lourdes was also a bit of a pack rat, and she kept all of her belongings in little bags and baggies strewn on the floor surrounding the recliner where she spent most of her waking hours. Earlier that week, in an attempt to tidy up, Enrique inadvertently threw out the baggie with the jewelry in it. Lourdes was beside herself with grief and anger. Michael, I haven't been able to sleep all week. I haven't been able to eat. The nurse just told me I lost 5 pounds. If you saw her, you'd see she didn't have 5 pounds to lose. And I'm so angry at Enrique. Why is he such a control freak? How could he be so careless? I invited her to gently dip into the spiritual waters of forgiveness, which was not a good call on my part, I will admit. So then I invited a reflection on what was the real gift that her mother had given her. Was it really jewelry, or was it her undying love and affection? And that's a gift that can't be lost or misplaced or thrown away. In a similar kind of way, it seemed Lourdes had precious little time left on the earth. Would she spend the gift of that time enjoying the love of her son, Enrique, or would she spend it stewing in her own anger and grief? She just might. That would be her choice. I sometimes think the very last power we have is the power to assign meaning to our stories. And who has the standing to tell our own stories? Do we alone own that, or do we sometimes give that power away to the opinion and interpretation of others? I imagine most of us here have had or do have somebody in our lives who is all too happy at any given moment to tell us exactly what kind of sense we should make of our lives, what it all means, and how we should feel about it. What about giving away our power to the values of the larger culture? As one who looks almost daily at the theme of success in life, both in my own life and certainly in the lives of the patients I serve, I will tell you that's one challenging bead to interpret. Unencumbered by the values of the larger culture, we've all been force-fed about just what a successful life looks like. What about ideas about health and healing? Are we limited to the images we see on magazine covers or ideas we hear from the medical establishment? Is it possible to inhabit a dying, cancer-ridden body and still claim a sense of wellness, even of healing? I believe so. I've seen it. But what about the reverse? Anna is a beautiful young woman, 30 years old, cured of Hodgkin's lymphoma, given the all clear by her doctor, go live your life. And yet she was paralyzed, immobilized with fear and grief, grieving so terribly the lost innocence of a limitless future. She now knew in no uncertain terms that any good thing can be snatched away in the blink of an eye. And what's more, she felt like damaged goods. No man will ever love me now. Her reading of that cancer bead would be very different than how her oncologist would read the very same bead. From what I observe, it can be a tricky business to attach ourselves to any particular meaning and see it as fixed. It can intensify our suffering, and I would suggest it can even stunt our spiritual growth, particularly when we add faith to the mix. Doug was a great guy. Early 50s, passionate student of life, ardent spiritual explorer. You might describe him best as sort of New Age. For Doug, his core spiritual value was that of forgiveness. Everything came down to that for him. So when he was diagnosed with colon cancer, he was convinced he got cancer because he'd never really forgiven his ex-wife, Tracy. They married when they were quite young, got divorced not long afterward, and though they've been divorced for years, he confessed, I'm still carrying so much anger at her for her betrayal of me. So this became his spiritual quest, a quest of forgiveness. He sought out books and teachers and exercises, tapes, until the ultimate test, he was going to call Tracy and tell her from the deepest, most sincere place in his heart, I forgive you. Well, I guess Tracy didn't realize she'd been in trouble all these years. She had moved on and was living a different story, but she did tell him she was glad he had found some peace and she wished him well. But when his oncologist told him that his recent scans revealed that his cancer was in complete remission, well, he had all the proof he needed. It was because of forgiveness. He would tell anyone who would listen with the passion of a zealot. That is, until the cancer came back. It can be a dangerous and cruel business, attaching ourselves to any particular meaning. In the early 1990s, the last big economic recession hit Los Angeles. I was in the design business at the time, and my design business went to zero. As a stopgap survival strategy, I took the CBEST test. I got an emergency teaching credential, And I was hired as a substitute teacher for Inglewood City Schools. Inglewood is a pretty disadvantaged inner city part of Los Angeles. And this was just a mere 2 weeks after the Rodney King uprisings in Los Angeles. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Soon enough, I discovered I did not have the constitution to face those schools every day. So, on my off days, I volunteered at Project Angel Food in Los Angeles, delivering home-cooked meals to homebound people with AIDS. And I got involved with a fledgling volunteer AIDS hospice organization called Project Nightlight. But at the time, I felt like the loser of the world. I was firmly attached to that idea. I assiduously avoided friends who might dare to ask the unthinkable question, "So what are you doing these days?" What's more, I was convinced that God had dispensed all the components necessary to live a successful life to everyone else except me. Firmly attached to that idea. Yet when I look back on that point of time now, I see it as the pivot point that made this part of my life possible in this career of chaplaincy that I love so much, though it took so many years to materialize. So am I to look back on that time now and call it a blessing? Hurting so badly that I wanted to die? Success and failure, it can be hard to tell which is which. A career or so before that, I was a professional dancer. In 1975, the Broadway musical, A Chorus Line, opened in New York City. I had never wanted anything so badly in my life as to be a part of that production. And that's without even having seen it. That's just listening to the cast album over and over again in my teeny apartment. Hey, those were my stories too, and I wanted to be a part of the telling. So January 1976, Michael Bennett, the director, creator, choreographer of the piece, came out to Los Angeles to hold open auditions for an LA company and for national tours. It was held at the old Aquarius Theater up on Sunset in Hollywood. Every dancer in Los Angeles was there. Everyone who thought they were a dancer was there. It went on for 2 days. Though I was broke, I went out and bought new dance clothes just to wear to the audition. Well, I danced and sang and danced and sang and danced and sang some more, and I survived cut after cut after cut. And toward the end of the second day, with maybe a dozen or so guys left, Michael Bennett said, "Okay, guys, we're going to ask you to read for parts now. We're going to hand out scripts." Oh, my God. But just a minute. Michael and Jim, will you step forward, please? And with that, his co-choreographer, Bob Avian, jumped up on the stage, came over to me and said, "Michael, you're a talented guy. You sing and dance beautifully. I'm sorry, there's just not a part for you in the show. Thank you so much for coming." Oh, God. It was like I couldn't breathe, as if I were kicked in the stomach. "What, you didn't know that yesterday?" I sucked up my tears, I scrambled to get my bag, and I darted out the stage door into the alley before I lost it completely. Jim was a few feet in front of me, in just as bad a shape. And just then, Charlene, who had been assisting Michael with the audition, and with whom I had worked on a few TV specials, she came darting out the stage door, and she ran up to Jim a few feet in front of me and put her arm around him to comfort him, and I overheard her offer him another job right there on the spot for an upcoming TV special as a sort of consolation. "Hey, what about me?" That memory is so vivid. Fast forward nearly 40 years. Every Saturday, I take a dance class for former professional dancers of, shall we say, a certain age. I call it my old farts dance class. It is heaven on a stick. It is church. It connects me to this very sacred, essential part of who I am and my spirit. It's taught by Walter Painter, a choreographer who had given me my very first professional job in 1973 at Sacramento Music Circus. He's assisted sometimes by his wife, Charlene, the one and same from the alley behind the Aquarius Theater in 1976. I love Charlene to pieces. It has never occurred to me to tell her my memory of that day. I mean, what's the point? It's ancient history. Well, a couple of summers ago, I got a terrible summer cold, and I was up all night coughing so violently that I ruptured a vocal cord, and I bled. I lost my voice completely. I couldn't utter a sound, even if I wanted to. I think my husband, Scott, was kind of happy about that, actually. The cold got better, but I still had no voice, so I went to dance class. And it just so happened that the national company of the Broadway revival of A Chorus Line was in town playing at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood. Some of the gals in my class had been in the original company. One had even starred in the London production. So I got to class a little early, and the women are sitting on the sofa and chatting and stretching. We're waiting for the ballet class to wrap it up in the studio before us. One of the women had just seen the production at the Pantages the night before. So she was offering her review of the piece, and then she started sharing her recollections of her time on the line, and others chimed in. Oh, yeah, I remember when Michael Bennett called me and asked me to fly to London to do it. And inside, I was just dying, and I couldn't talk. I could only listen. But it was as if a 40-year-old scab had been ripped right off, and all of those feelings of rejection and dejection and loss and disappointment and envy, it all came flooding back. As if it were yesterday. And just then, Charlene chimes in with, oh, yeah, I remember Michael Bennett called me and asked me to help him with the audition out here in Los Angeles. And I told him, but Michael, I haven't even seen the show yet. And he said, Charlene, the audition is the show. You're telling me. But inside, I was dying. I so desperately wanted to share and just say, I was there that day. This is what happened to me. And I couldn't talk. And in an instant, I had this awakening to the perfection of this moment that I couldn't talk, that I could only listen because it's my story. It's not anybody else's story. It's certainly not Charlene's story. It really doesn't even have anything to do with Charlene. While it might be a significant point on my biography, it's not even a blip on hers. It only matters to the degree I've assigned it meaning on my journey. And what if in the end it doesn't mean anything at all? Yes, we might all use our stories to perhaps fascinate us, inspire us, to explain us to ourselves or each other. Or in this case, perhaps to anchor me into a deep place of humility and compassion for perhaps those wounds that never really heal. But it would be our folly, I think, to attach ourselves to any particular meaning. Two summers ago, I attended my 40th high school reunion, Long Beach Wilson High School, class of 1972. There aren't too many settings that are more ripe for the telling of stories than a high school reunion. And I have found if we keep our hearts and eyes open, any greater opportunity to reevaluate and reinterpret those formative stories, to loosen our grip on their meaning. I've attended each reunion in 10-year increments, and each one seems to have its own flavor and personality. At the 10-year, it seemed everybody wanted to show off and prove how successful they were. By this stage in life, most have been humbled by life and loss a bit. I always experience these as a compressed kind of time warp. I'm 57 and I'm 14 in the same moment, and I see everybody else through the same lens. I look right past the wrinkles and the missing hair and the extra pounds, and I still see the handsome football player and the perky cheerleader and the bully and the one who made me laugh so hard in ninth grade English. Yet everyone's memory doesn't serve them quite so well. Randy Tischauer came up to me and said, yeah, Mike, I remember you always walking around in your Letterman's jacket. No, Randy, that would not have been me. Just then, Gary Wilson, who'd known me since I was in third grade and knew me for the sissy that I was, chimed in with, oh, trust me on this, Randy, Mike never would have had a letter in anything. Thanks, Gary. I was Mike then. The highlight of my evening came late. I was looking for an empty table to just sit down and catch my breath from all of this overwhelming nostalgia. And I wasn't seated but a few moments, and up walked Cheryl Young. Hi, Mike. Remember me? I did remember Cheryl. I remembered her since junior high, though I'm certain we never had a class together, and I can't recall even having a single conversation with her. But I knew who she was. She had this short mop of curly hair and this wide silk scarf tied around her head, and she had the sweetest smile, and she spoke with a kind of simplicity that made me think a little something else might be going on here. Well, sure, I remember you, Cheryl. Have a seat. How are you? How's life? Well, I've had some health problems, she said. I had thyroid cancer, and earlier this year, I had an AVM. Do you know what that is? Well, yes, I do. It's an arterial venous malformation. I used to work on the neuro floor. And with that, she pulled back her wig to reveal a very nasty scar across her skull. I'm so sorry to hear that, Cheryl. I asked to hear a bit more about her story, and in what felt like a holy instant, I had this awakening that I have no need whatsoever to hear any more of her story. What's more, I have no need whatsoever to share anything of mine. I only felt an urgent need to say, Cheryl, I'm just so glad you're here. Meaning at the reunion, of course, but much more deeply here in life. Can I give you a hug? I asked. Oh, yes, please. And when I hugged her, I had this overwhelming sensation that if there is such a place as heaven, this must be what it's like. Our stories just melt away. They just don't matter anymore. They're only the circuitous path that brought us on this crazy journey to this point in time where we can meet and we can hug and we can say, I'm glad you're here. A year ago, last May, Glenn Johnston, a beloved member of my family, my mom's partner for the last 15 years, the love of her life that she waited 70 years to find, took his own life. Approaching 90, in failing health, resolute he would not die in a hospital or nursing home, and he would not be a burden to anyone else, he chose to write the ending to his own story. He left my mom a note on a corner scrap of yellow-lined paper. Three words. I love you. He left the note on the unfinished jigsaw puzzle he was working on the night before. 90 years of life, it all boiled down to three words on a scrap of yellow-lined paper. That is one bead, it seems, that we turn over and over and over again in our hand, trying to understand it. The weight of it, the facets of it, the texture, the color. It's so precious, we don't want to lose that one. We want more. We might spend our whole lives stringing and restringing our beads, trying to make sense of it all, figure it out. And it might all come down to that one bead. Maybe our stories really do matter. Maybe they're everything, in fact, that make us who we are. And maybe they're just stories. As for myself, I will just say, I'm glad you're here. So be it.